Dokirin, Sunday, 3rd May, 1981. Man has always been interested as regards the ultimate origin of all things and of all life. Right from the earliest prehistoric times. And of course, in the very early days, he had primitive ideas which he expressed on the whole anthropomorphically. Everything had a spirit. Even a river or a particular rock or a tree or anything whatsoever had a spirit attached to it. Gods and godlings, spirits everywhere and in everything. But during the last 6,000 years, particularly, considerable changes have taken place in man's development and consequently in his ideas of the ultimate origin of things. He realized that when the mind became quiet and was in the right mood, so to say, he would receive impressions of a something quite other than what his senses conveyed to him and what his brain could make through in any intellectual process of what that something was. It was a mysterious something. He naturally associated it at first with the gods and goddesses and so forth, which were the beliefs of primitive peoples for several scores of thousands of years. But he realized that it was this quiet state of the mind, and when the sense functions were in a peaceful condition, that he had this sense of the something other which was quite transcendent to him. Also, in his dreams, he saw dead people. And if he was a warrior or a person who in his lifetime had to fight for his existence against enemies and slain them, naturally when he woke up from that dream, he felt frightened. How is it I slew that man? Is he really dead or is he still alive in some mysterious form? Supposing he is like one of these spirits who are worshipped and who are regarded as possessed of magical powers, he might still be able to harm me. And this perhaps was one of the factors which was the origin of those ritual practices which people in the very old days went through in order to pacify the spirits of the dead. And they extended that to the gods and goddesses also, so that they would be favorable to them always, and made sacrifices to them and so forth. This is only one of the factors, this sense of insecurity and uncertainty, and this wonder whether death was the end of all things, or whether there was a survival and so forth. And if there was a survival, it was in some ways related to the ultimate origin or origins of all life and all things. But there came the point when this capacity to enter into the deep states of consciousness grew greater and greater through the practice of quietness and silence. And ultimately, there arose those few who actually realized what we may today call God or Brahman or transcendence or whatever you like to call it. And this realization of transcendence was particularly characterized as a reality which is a unitary wholeness, a perfect holiness, therefore. They realized that. And having realized that, and having experienced the attendant and consequent states of great bliss, of an intense bliss, they regarded that as the ultimate of all things. And they made, first of all, their affirmations that there is this transcendent. Now, it's one of the interesting characteristics with regard to the teachings of all the spiritual teachers of the world, that every single one of them has affirmed transcendence as an absolute fact. Those people never argued about transcendence. They never entered into a discussion whether God is or is not, or could he be, or could there be a God, or could there not be a God. They just made the affirmation that the transcendent is, and most of them made the affirmation in the form of, especially with the theistic religions, in the form of a divine personality. It is interesting to note how and why this affirmation of the transcendent as a divine personality or a divine immortal being was made. Man's tendency, when he wants to interpret that which is beyond ordinary experience in the world of the sense and the discursive logical mind, his tendency is to interpret the transcendent, the other than himself, in terms of himself. I am a man. I have such and such qualities, such and such powers, and so on. That other is a being, which of course is also tantamount to saying he's a man, possessed of extraordinary powers and qualities and so forth. And so the God idea of the theistic religions developed in that way. In addition to making affirmations of the fact of transcendence, they also made affirmations about the transcendent. And some of them discovered that it was impossible really to make affirmations about transcendence, and others did not discover that. So they made statements presenting God really in the image of man, more or less, but a glorified man, a perfected man. They themselves, of course, if they had been through a proper discipline by which their own psyches were utterly purified and their minds had attained some degree of clarification and the capacity really to see into the truth of things, they did not make affirmations about transcendence. They gave hints, though, because it is impossible to communicate with other people unless one speaks in the terms which are possible to us, namely dualistic terms. We live in the world of dualistic language and dualistic conceiving. We have all the pairs of opposites for every quality and so forth. So good and evil, kind and cruel, faithful and unfaithful, true and false, and all that sort of thing. So we have this dualism. And particularly the followers of the original teachers, and there were many of them, not only the founders of the religions, there have been many of them, literally hundreds of them in human history. The followers, anxious to propagate the religion, to propagate the teaching, because it had helped them and brought them some sort of security and happiness, built up theologies and philosophical systems based upon their perceptions, which were, of course, faulty perceptions. That we must bear in mind. Not altogether faulty, but considerably faulty. There was an element of truth covered by a layer of falsity involved in all this. And thus, they built up, it is the followers particularly, who built up religious systems of doctrines and dogmas, and they invented rituals purporting to put people in touch with the divine, in touch with the supreme. Now, for the multitudes, the doctrines are a matter of blind belief. Two reasons particularly. One, the incapacity of people, the intellectual incapacity, to penetrate sufficiently deeply. And secondly, lack of interest. They were too concerned with the process of daily living, of surviving, and so forth, to be worried about what is the real truth of the matter, to discover the truth for themselves. So those who gave the original teachings, and their followers, the priesthood and all that, they were the repositories of divine knowledge, and therefore all that they had to do was to ask the priest what was the truth of this matter, rather, as far as the religious life and the context of religious teaching was concerned. And they were more or less satisfied with what he said. What they did not understand was that whatever the priest or the living teacher, the true teacher, said, had to be interpreted by the listener. This is where the snag lay. Supposing it were possible to speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Humanly, actually, all over the world, it is quite impossible to do so. But supposing that were possible, at least to a certain degree, the question remains, how far is this man's intelligence, his capacity to perceive the truth as the truth, how far has it developed? Because what he will do is that he will interpret the words and the concepts which those words represent in his own way. He has no option in the matter. He hasn't got the ability to do otherwise. So this is one of the very important factors which has been missed out of consideration throughout human history. Now, what we must bear in mind is this. When those few, through reaching the peak of their own religious development as such, through their own purification and the clarification of their mind, through the complete emptying of the psyche, so that mind in its transcendence could function freely through these people, then they presented God as the realization of transcendence as they saw it, and declared sometimes that this was a revelation directly from the transcendent itself. Now, the greatest of the teachers didn't do that. They suggested it sometimes in certain ways. You know how Jesus said, "If my Father had not told me these things, I would not be telling it to you myself." Of course, there is a very profound and deep truth hidden in that statement. When a religia has reached that stage of complete purification, he is no longer confined in consciousness to his own limited consciousness. He is also free from the limitations imposed by his sense functioning and his logical, discursive brain process. He is free of all that. And so he is in tune. No more than that. He is completely in tune with the transcendent, at the transcendent level. So, this experience, working upon the psychophysical organism, in due time gives rise to formulation as certain concepts, the bulk of which negate the worldly concepts with which he and all others are acquainted. Those concepts arise, which are very inspiring very often, and their inspiration lasts for centuries, even millennia in several cases. And he's able, therefore, to inspire the listener or the reader, as the case may be, with that energy which will help the listener or reader to progress in his religious development. Now, this has to be borne in mind, but in the case of every teacher, there are limitations, there are drawbacks. Whosoever that teacher may be, whatsoever he may have said, if that were not the case, there'd be no possibility of progress for the rest of human evolution on the globe. Where his development and his coming to fruition as a human being, a truly human being, a fully religious being is concerned. There is always bound to be some change or other introduced by each teacher as time goes on. This is where time plays its part, because time reveals eternity ultimately. And in the process of that revelation of eternity, we may arbitrarily postulate that the truth is absolute and immutable, unchangeable and unchanging. All right, we may postulate that about eternity. But since the revelation of eternity proceeds step by step through time with human development, therefore time has its influence, and therefore as new teachers arise, new elements of realization come into being. I should say not so much new elements of realization, because element implies a particular something, but new intensities of realization come into being. The intensity of realization today, which is possible to human beings, is much greater than it was in the time of Jesus or the Buddha or Zarathustra or the Upanishadic teachers. It is much greater, provided there are individuals who can understand what the purpose of their existence is, how that purpose can be fulfilled by this discipline, this learning process, this happy learning and discovering process by the psychophysical individual, the existential being. This affirmation that the scriptures are a direct revelation by God or to the teacher has had many unfortunate results. It pushes God out as a separate being. And then, of course, we all suffer from that self-contradictory statement that God is the eternal, immortal, ultimate being who is an entity wholly other than you or me, the creature. He is the creator, we are the created, and he is separate. I mean, that is perfectly ridiculous, because any entity which is postulated comes to birth, progresses, lives, and dies. If you will project a separate being out of your own brain, that being is bound to become a fossil in course of time. It's impossible for it to be otherwise. Transcendence can never be presented as an immortal, separate entity. Cannot be done. This is where the Hindus, I think, touched the peaks. They avoided that mistake in presenting Brahman. Their presentation of Brahman does away with that altogether, saves man from that. And also, by postulating God in that way, the people postulated God as something totally unattainable, and only by the grace of God, provided we followed a certain routine of what was laid down as the good life was fulfilled, by the grace of God we could be in relationship with God after we were dead. But if you examine the religious teachings very carefully and with a penetrating mind and with a pure psyche, you will see that all the great teachings of the religions deal with us here and now, and whatsoever they showed was the fruition of our life, was a fruition here and now, and not in any mythical hereafter. This is a very, very important point. I could pick out texts from the various religions to show that of necessity must be the case. Of course, your mind may quite disagree with that. I can't. For me, this is the truth. This is the fact. So I have to say what seems to me the fact of the matter. Now, the traditional teachings thus built up was hand. Excuse me. Was handed down generation after generation. Now, what is the consequence of all that as far as we today are concerned? What happens to us? What happens to you and to me? Let us just picture our own life story, and I'll talk in the first person. I am born, right? That's the start. And then, inevitably, I fall in with the mode of life, the customs and practices of my family, society, nation, and the religion of my parents. You see, we are all brought up in a religion. Nowadays, of course, this doesn't quite hold good. The bulk of people are not brought up in any religion. They are just left out in the streets to do what they think they want to do. But this is how we are brought up. All right. I am taken to the church or the temple, whichever it is, or the mosque. I am taught certain prayers which I have to memorize, which is very easy when you are a very little child. You memorize the sounds quite easily, but they are utterly meaningless to you. And especially in a case like mine, where our prayers are in the Avestan language. My mother tongue was Gujarati, and the language which I learned later on, and which really is my language, is English. But those Avestan sounds, pretty as they sounded, they were quite pleasant sounding sounds, you see, and sonorous and impressive. They meant nothing to me whatsoever. However, one learns them, and I am influenced by a ritual which is called the worship of God and of the teacher, the founder of the religion. And the founder of the religion is usually regarded as the intermediary, the indispensable intermediary between me or you and God, or whatever name we give to the ultimate, to the transcendent as such. Now, what is one of the results of this? This brings about exclusiveness. Because we live in a world where there are other religions, other churches, other temples, other mosques, and their service, their method of worship and everything has differences, considerable differences from my own. I was born of Parsi parents, and Parsis are Zarathustrians by birth, the followers of Zarathustra, you see. And of course, with the typical egoism and vanity and absurdity characteristic of human beings, our parents and teachers and friends belonging to our own society or nation impress upon us that we should keep out of other religions. We should shun them or even condemn them as not being the true religion and so forth. So man is set up against man right from infancy onwards. I was taught all these things, you see, and I was taught to look down upon all other religions. That ours was the supreme one, the superior one, and the only one worthwhile following. The big I am, of course, comes out here as usual. And I must confess that when I first went to school, I was a little over 4 years of age. When I first went to school, it was a church missionary society's ladies' college, which had a kindergarten department, which was co-educational. After that, they were all girls. Well, now we used to have morning assembly. And for the first time in my life, I came across a ritual which was so different from ours. I must admit, our Zarathustrian ritual is a very joyous, happy ritual. And here we all had to shut our eyes, you see, and then we came to, the singing of the hymn was quite pleasant. It was a nice tune, jolly sometimes, you see, and so forth. And especially when they talk of onward Christian soldiers marching as to war, you know what little children are like. They're always ready to march the moment they hear a brass band. All that was very nice. But when we came to the Lord's Prayer, Our Father, which art in heaven. Do you know what I heard as a child? Because, you know, this was pronounced in a way which I couldn't quite grasp. Ah, Father. A-H. Ah, Father. And which art was a, perhaps I could spell it this way, W-I-C-H-A-T or something like which art. Our Father, which art in heaven, and where is heaven? Goodness knows. See, although I did ask my mother when I was about 3 all these questions, I'll come to that later. Which art in heaven? And then, hallowed be thy name, I always heard as, hallow be thy name. Now I thought, this was absolutely terrible. How could a religion be so irreverent to say hello to God? It was totally impossible for me, you see. And again, you know, the atmosphere of a church was somewhat dark and twilighty and gloomy as compared with a Zarathustrian fire temple, which was open and light and full of delight, so to say. See. So you can appreciate the kind of influence which these rituals and so on exert upon people. And as I said, by the time I was about 3, I was curious about the deep things, and began to ask the deep questions about myself. Whence did I come? From where did I come? And of course I couldn't ask my father, he was away at work all day, and I was fast asleep by the time he returned home at night. And mother said, "You came out of me." So I would say, "What? This came out of that?" And she would say, "Yes." And I said, "Then when you ask me to pray to God, where does God come in?" "Oh, God really made you, made your soul, you see. And that is something quite different. Now, I wanted to know the difference." And she couldn't answer. So, the whence always remained a great problem. And then sometimes she would tell me a nice little yarn about how I came. She was sitting in the garden. We had a nice little garden, lovely flowers and of course jasmine and those things have a very intense, pleasant smell in the tropics. Mother said, "I was sitting out in the garden, and suddenly God appeared up, high up above me, with a little baby in his hands, you see, and called me by name and said, 'Hold this baby,' you see, and threw it down to me." I don't know what the velocity of approach was under the influence of gravity, but my mother held me, you see, and kept me safe. This is what I was told. And my goodness, in a way I was terrified. I thought, my goodness, supposing you had missed. You see? And how inconsiderate of God to do a thing like that, to take such a risk. I might have died. And yet I didn't quite know what dying implied, although I saw dead creatures about. But it never struck me that human beings die in the same way. So you see, all sorts of deep questions kept coming out, which never received proper answers. There was the question of the whence. There was the question of the whither. What will happen when I have finished my life and am dead? Oh, now if you are really good and live as a good Zarathustrian and say your prayers regularly every day, you will go to heaven and God will reward you. Holding the carrot, you know. God will reward you. Well, that wasn't very satisfactory either, because there wasn't any certainty about it. And supposing I wasn't good, I used to ask my mother, "Oh, God will punish you." I thought this was a funny God who has his own ideas about rewarding goodness and punishing badness. And then naturally the question arose, what is the good and what is the bad? And of course this became a little bit too deep for the parental dignitary, and I was sent out to play or something like that, or given something to eat to keep me quiet. Then I would ask, how can one make certain about going to heaven after you're dead? And that's the place of happiness, and happiness only. How can we be certain about that? And of course, it was the same answer. You must live the good life, you must be a good boy, and do what your parents tell you, do what your teachers tell you, and live truthfully, kindly, lovingly, and all the rest of it, you know. So, it was all a bit of a jumble to me. I didn't quite understand what it was all about. By this time, of course, I was already going to school and had this experience of another faith. And not only another faith, but our servants were Buddhists and some were Hindus. Our rickshaw coolie was a Hindu, Our cook was a Buddhist, you see. And so they had different ideas. And they used to have their own little prayers by themselves and so forth. And I used to listen very, very intently and couldn't understand a word, of course. This was neither English nor Gujarati. However, the result is that the answers, I realized now, of course, with hindsight, that the answers are understood in a childish way by the childish brain. One of the worst things, of course, is the projection of God as a superman up in the heavens and so forth, a rewarder and a punisher and so forth. And the devil, Ahriman, as in Zarathustrian teaching, Satan was not a punisher. He was the devil who carried out the sentence. God condemned, and Satan carried out the sentence. And we had most dramatic presentations of all the terrible punishments that take place, you know, boiled in oil and molten metal and all kinds of horrible things like that. Well, you know, for a child to grow up with that sort of information is something incredibly bad, thoroughly bad. I sometimes thought, if I can't be really good, I better kill myself before I'm so bad that I'll be put into hell. One had to go through all that. But these ideas, which are put into the child mind right in the very early stages, in infancy in fact, ultimately, when one grows, gets to the proper boyhood or girlhood stage, one forgets all that up to a point, but it has sunk deep into the unconscious and exerts a very unfortunate conditioning influence upon the rest of one's life, almost the rest of one's life, unless one is fortunate enough to be deeply interested in the religious life and learn to live in that manner by which the psyche undergoes true purification and the mind becomes clear-sighted, truly clear-sighted, so that nous, Plato's nous, or the Indian buddhi, can really begin to function and a sense of transcendence awakens in one. If that happens, then one is really fortunate. That is, I suppose, in a sense, the greatest good fortune that can befall any man. The result of the early conditioning, and not only the childhood conditioning, but the conditioning through the adolescent years and the adult years, is something which keeps our mind unfree to examine all experience for what it actually is. And all our experience comes to us through our senses in the first instance. Our sense functions are responsible for that. And we all know how the senses function. But not all of us fully appreciate the fact that we do not really see, really hear with due and full attention. Our attention wanders. Our perceptions, whatever they are fuddled, muddled perceptions because of the influence of this conditioning. Whenever we see something, we think we see that. It may be the fact, it may not be the fact. In certain cases, of course, it is the fact. I am looking at that lamp there and I see that it is that lamp. There is nothing more to see about that. There is nothing illusory about that. But when we see most of the things that happen around us, in us, and especially when we see into or try to see into the nature of human beings and so forth, then we interpret the impressions conveyed to us by our conditioned brains. And that interpretation is, with rare exceptions, a misinterpretation. Only when one has really lived long enough and learned how to discriminate between true perception and false perception, does it become possible to see truly. Then we see truly. That is to say, as far as the influence of sense activity is concerned, there is that which is very much beyond sense activity, which is characteristic of the mind in its wholeness, in its reality. And that is something which extremely few of us ever come across and ever experience. And still fewer are able to utilize that faculty. There are dormant faculties in the mind. And these dormant faculties get stimulated, come to life and grow in us through the years if we are truly interested and concerned with living the religious life. And there is no other way. Scientific observation helps to a degree to learn to see truly. And one of the wonderful things about modern science is just this, that science itself has come to the point where it recognizes the factor of the particular human being who is looking, observing the experiment or the process or whatever it is, and the influence of consciousness. We have actually come to the point where scientists acknowledge that the next steps will involve the understanding of the processes of the human mind and consciousness in all scientific research and experimentation. That is one of the wonderful signs of the present part of our century. And it's very interesting to observe that at the beginning of the centuries, we made a tremendous breakthrough the terrible barrier between matter and spirit. When science discovered that energy, pure energy, and what we call matter or mass, energy and mass are interchangeable, and that we ourselves have developed sufficient power to change mass into energy, although we haven't discovered the ways and means of changing pure energy into mass, into matter. That was the first great breakthrough. After that breakthrough, it was absurd for anybody to talk in terms of mind and spirit being spiritual and completely different from concrete matter. That is nonsense. My use of the phrase one total reality is completely justified by science too. It is just one whole reality manifesting in various grades of manifestation. What we call spirit, if you like, is the subtlest expression of this primordial creative energy, of this absolutely pure consciousness. And creative energy and pure consciousness are an identity. Science itself may one day, perhaps in the next century, really discover that through its work. They are an identity. And what we call matter is the concretest expression in the solid state of this same primordial creative energy. And this, if you like, is perhaps the best way of talking about transcendence and about God and so forth in our day and age. A primordial creative energy which is identical with absolutely pure consciousness. An absolutely pure consciousness is a consciousness that doesn't know anything at all, in the sense that you and I know things with our brain, with the activity of our brains, which synthesize our sense impressions through the sense organs. Whatever the brain synthesizes of the sense impressions through the sense organs are only pictures of the actual reality. They are only photographs, and still photographs, if you like, you see. They are not the actual reality. When you can enter the deep states of consciousness, you will find that the brain is entirely defeated as far as talking about that awareness of reality is concerned. But those who can do it still will talk about it, because some sort of suggestiveness must be made in order to inspire the person who is truly seeking and who is already sufficiently developed to be ripe and ready for receiving such a inspiration, can be inspired to go further and let that sense of transcendence in him, which is a spark, burst into flame ultimately. And then he knows the context of truth, the realm of the ultimate realities is the realm of silence, that absolute perfect silence, which is the ultimate void, void of all evil, void of all disturbance, but which holds in potentiality the plenitude which manifests as cosmos and enables this great drama and play of life to come into being and give opportunities to the manifestations of this creative, primordial creative energy to come to fruition in the particular ways which express their uniqueness. The flower as the flower, the gem as the gem, a human being as the perfected holy one, the human being in the true sense of the word. And that is this transcendent creative energy coming to fruition through each and everything in the cosmos as such. So our task lies in becoming free of all the limitations, the restrictions imposed upon us through our conditioning and the faulty way in which our sense functioning impresses us with the nature of reality, of truth. Because if we can do that, then transcendence, God, use any word you like, will be an actual functioning reality through your being, in your being, in your whole life. And that will be a state of supreme blessedness, and you will be a truly a benediction in the world in which you live.